to express my gratitude to those who have invited me, and the only thing being first today and getting it settled, the others won't have to appear. When this invitation first came from Brother Lace, conveyed to me by Brother Flatt, Matthew 15:1-9, he said, and you just said Matthew 19:1-12. Well, not a great deal of difference there. But my first reaction was, no. What could I say that has not been said? That was the way I first felt. And I still feel that way. But I finally decided to do it on the basis of it being a learning experience for myself. I feel somewhat as Tasker in his commentary, he says, this passage about divorce is so difficult. And there have been so many diverse interpretations given by scholars, sections of the church, that a commentator may well feel reluctant to express any opinion at all, lest he should be guilty of adding to the exegetical and ecclesiastical confusion. Someone mentioned to me as I was coming up here, hoped I came through all right. I said, I don't know whether you like it or not. I said, do you think the question is easy? If you do, you won't like what I'm going to say. Because I don't think it's easy. Oh, I guess maybe the passage might not be all that difficult, most of it, if it just weren't for the fact that people, human beings, get themselves into such ridiculous messes. Of course, I get a lot of letters on divorce, and I get a lot of telephone calls. Just about seems telephone ring, Brother Kelsey, I have a question I want to ask you, and I'm hoping it'll be something about qualification of elders or something like that. But no, it's divorce. I get a letter, a very important matter, and I hope he's going to ask about what's the unpardonable sin, but he doesn't. And I have just about quit giving any kind of counsel by mail, because whoever writes it can't tell me all the details. And also, I have quit giving opinions when some third person tells me about a case over here, because he doesn't know all about it either. In both cases, I say I want to talk to the man himself. The mailer asked a very good question when he asked, does our law judge a man before it hear him? So I'm not going to be writing any solutions anymore. And I'm not going to be giving any solutions to a third party who's telling me about all that over there, because he doesn't know all of it. Does our law judge a man before it hear him? I want to hear him. You know, there is a lot of divergence among Christians on this question, but that isn't something that's just happened. It always has been. And as I look back into the literature of the past century, I see brethren differing. You look at the Gospel Advocate through the years, at the query department. There would be seasons where it would just be filled week after week after week. When Lipscomb and Sewell were conducting it, and as their book on Queries and Answers show, question after question, and it wouldn't stay down. And when R.L. Whiteside was conducting it, question after question. Brother Brewer was telling me one time, G.C. Brewer, that after he wrote his series of articles in The Advocate, that it took him 2 years to dispense with all of the questions and letters that came about as a result of it. But I am very much impressed at the attitude those men had. And I don't know of a better word to use than the word restraint. They had a lot of restraint in discussing this. And, of course, even the archangel had some restraint in rebuking Satan. We need a lot of restraint. Just as a little instance of Whiteside, about restraint and some of the ways that he answered questions. You can tell that his mood varies through the years as these questions keep coming. He deals with this question about aliens divorcing and then being baptized, and that whether that takes care of it. Says it doesn't. He said, it is argued that aliens may divorce for any cause and remarry, and then all their sins are forgiven when they obey the gospel. And it is argued that to say that their sins are not forgiven is to say that they have committed the unpardonable sin. But there may be a wide difference between an unforgiven sin and an unpardonable sin. Repentance comes before forgiveness. If their marriage was a sin, can they repent of that sin and still continue in it? If they were living in adultery, are we to be seriously told that obedience, or rather a form of obedience to the gospel, changed adultery into virtue? Where would such a theory lead? If a man steals a car, rides to meeting, and then goes through the form of obedience to the gospel, would that act make his possession right in the sight of God? It is argued also, as the alien is not in covenant relationship with the Lord takes no notice of what he does. And then not being under the law, he violates no law. But if that sort of reasoning is true, what makes an alien a sinner at all? Well, he goes on quite at length on that. And then he keeps on, and then other questions keep coming. He comes to this, but it seems to me that we say a lot more about this matter of divorce and marrying than did the apostles. Read their letters and also study their preaching and see how little they said about the matter. And yet the marriage vows were then treated more lightly, if possible, than they are now. What is the explanation? Were they more lenient toward the ignorant and the erring than you and I are? Did they baptize those who demanded baptism without looking into what they had formerly done? He's not contradicting what he said, he's just wondering. Would they have said what I have said about divorce and marriage among aliens? I've wondered that at times when I've said something. Would they have said it? Perhaps we should study from this angle more than we've yet done so. He's always pleading for us to keep studying. Well, there are many more instances in these men that I could give. There are 30 grounds for divorce in the 50 states today. And it's very easy to get a divorce, most any state. Not all of them. Not as easy in some as in others. It's been quite a journey from the days of colonial America to present Reno. And yet the history of divorce has been a very interesting one. However, it has been a history that could not be written in one history, because it would take 50 histories. The history of divorce would have to be written about each state, 50 states. In the states, most commonly recognized grounds are adultery, desertion, felony conviction, and alcoholism. 39 of the 50 states recognize all of these, and 6 of the other 11 recognize all but one of them. In the states, various periods of residency are required. 33 states require 1 year's residency. Massachusetts requires 5 years, Connecticut 3 years. 6 states require 6 months or less. But it has not always been that easy in America. Back in the day, in the colonial days, when the people were still under the rule of Britain, in the 1600s, Massachusetts recognized 4 grounds: adultery, desertion, impotence, and affinity. A little bit later in Massachusetts, in the year 1794, they permitted divorce if the husband had been away at sea for 7 years. In 1698, another drastic change was made and brought down from 7 years to 3 years if he had been away for 3 years and hadn't been heard of or from. In the same century, in the 1600s in Connecticut, there were 4 grounds: adultery, fraudulent contract, willful desertion for 3 years, or 7 years absence without being heard from or of. In Rhode Island, adultery only, and later they added 5 years absence without being heard from. Virginia did not allow absolute divorce, but allowed separation from bed and board on the grounds of adultery and cruelty. This is an expression I'm going to be using quite a bit, this separation from bed and board. Not going to use the Latin expression that all the commentaries use. But did you know that that's something the New Testament doesn't allow, is separation from bed and board? We'll come back to that a little later. At least I'm going to throw some things out here today. I noticed all the questions they said would like to be covered. Somebody has to get them out. So I guess I'd be about as good one as any to get some of these out. In New York and New Jersey, the history is very scant, and yet they were very strict. However, the British government intervened and clamped down and put an end to legislation. And then there was the Revolution. And after the Revolution, there was a more liberal attitude toward divorce everywhere. Now, after the Revolution, Pennsylvania allows divorce on 4 grounds, and separation from bed and board on 1 ground, and that was extreme cruelty. Massachusetts on 3 grounds, but separation from bed and board on extreme cruelty. New Hampshire, 4 grounds. Georgia allowed divorce on 8 grounds in 1850. New York was still more cautious, only on adultery. But in New York in 1827, they defined 5 grounds for annulment. Those 5 grounds for annulment being one of the two, or both of them, being under the age of consent at the time of marriage; 2, bigamy; 3, the person marrying being a lunatic or an idiot at the time of marriage; and 4, obtain consent by force; and then finally, physical impotence. In those days, Timothy Dwight and many other preachers crusaded against divorce, and during the Civil War, the question dropped into the background. But after the Civil War in the latter part of the 19th century, it was debated far and wide, even in the great metropolitan newspapers, Horace Greeley and many others entering into the conflict. Every view was taken. The free love movement made its appearance. New York's laws remained rigid. the people of New York began seeking divorce elsewhere. There was the westward migration. Chicago became a mecca for residents of New York. In the state of New York, all kinds of faked photography and so forth, since adultery was the only ground. In the latter part of the 1800s, California expanded to 6 grounds for divorce, and California served as a model for most of the other western states, particularly Nevada. A short residence was required in the western states, and this, of course, made them very attractive to people who did not want to wait for divorce. In Wyoming, 6 months' residence was required. The Oklahoma Territory was an easy place for divorce, and many went there. All through this time, there were various attempts to make this a federal thing. As a matter of fact, under President Theodore Roosevelt and President Franklin Roosevelt, there were serious efforts to make this a federal matter, but it was always passed back to the states. It was destined to remain with the states. In 1931, in the state of Nevada, the residency requirement was reduced to 6 weeks, that is, a person could get a divorce on the 43rd day. 9 grounds were given: adultery, cruelty, desertion, non-support, alcoholism, felony, impotency, 5 years separation without cohabitation, and 5 years insanity. Nevada did not really make it more liberal, but they did make proof more easy than the other states. Some of the wealthy Americans began going to France for divorces, especially from the state of New York. 1926, 300 couples went to France, but France, having hung out the welcome sign, soon retracted it, tightened the laws of residency, and discouraged it. But about the same time, Mexico hung out the shingle, the welcome sign, and left it there, and it stays to this day. Only a few days residence required in Mexico, and even mail order divorces are obtainable on the Chihuahua law, which gives divorces on 20 different grounds, the most used one being incompatibility of character. The Great Depression in the 30s, which some of us remember so well, influenced the legislatures of some states to try to attract tourist trade by way of the divorce route. Idaho, Arkansas, Wyoming, and Florida decreased residency. Wyoming reduced to 60 days. Florida reduced to 3 months. There came about what was known as migratory divorce. New York remained strict on divorce, but since 1829, annulment has been permitted on various grounds. Now, this idea of annulment, which of course is a Catholic doctrine, it is, as it is so commonly used. Annulment logically rested upon conditions existing at the time of marriage which made the contract void. The theory of annulment says that it was no marriage, that there were certain impediments existing which would make it legal to say it was not a true marriage. This is how the Catholics have held on to the indissolubility of marriage, and at the same time granted all the divorces, is by calling them annulments. The fact that New York was giving annulments to all of these years shows the Catholic vote, Catholic influence. While it is true that the Catholics have used this wrongly, and really calling it that doesn't make it that, I have a bit of sympathy for at least some idea of annulment. That is, I hold to the idea that there is such a thing as legitimate annulment. That is, if there were impediments existing at the time of the marriage so that it was not a true marriage, if it was entered into under false intentions or deception and not true commitment, that It was not marriage, and therefore it would be all right to call it null and void and no marriage. I'm not going to have time to go into all of these, but I at least will throw that out as a possibility. But I do not, of course, go over the Catholics as far as they go. New York kept on enlarging the annulments. They did say that a life sentence in prison dissolved the marriage. The Enoch Arden Law was introduced in 1922. The spouse was absent for 5 years. It dissolved the marriage. 1928, annulment was permitted if one person was incurably insane for 5 years. After World War II, divorce soared to unprecedented heights, so that today, Reno, walk in, after having been there for 43 days, be granted a divorce, get married the same day as, I can remember back in 1959, one of the well-known movie stars did. So our nation today presents a sordid picture. And this is the kind of a world the church lives in and to which she is to carry the good news. To look at it with all of its ramifications might cause us to be disheartened. But look at the world into which Christianity was born. Look at the Jewish world that permitted divorce on every ground. Was anything any worse? Yes. The Roman world was. Was anything worse than the Roman world? Yes, the Greek world was. It's impossible for us to realize the degradation of the Greek-Roman world. 14 of the first 15 Roman emperors were practicing homosexuals. It is doubtful if ever there was such a cataract of immorality in any age as in the years when Christianity came into the world. I doubt that our condition in America today is anything like as bad as it was then. Now, it was this kind of a world that Jesus lived in and the apostles lived in, and when we look at Matthew 19, 1 and 2, Jesus is traveling. He is going to Judea, leaving Galilee, and taking the shortcut, taking another route, going through the borders of Judea beyond the Jordan, which was Perea. This is new territory for Jesus. He traveled slowly. Great crowds followed, and he healed many of them of their sick. We move to verse 3. Pharisees came trying him and saying, let's pause just there. The Pharisees of Perea were of the same type and temper as those of Galilee or Jerusalem. They desire to ensnare Jesus. They're trying to get him to make a pronouncement that will discredit him. And so they say, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Is it lawful? What are they asking? Is it lawful? They are asking, does the law of Moses allow this? Now, this is not an unusual question for them. The motive is sinister, as always, with them. For instance, when they ask him, is it lawful to heal on a Sabbath? They meant, is it in harmony with the law of Moses? When they ask him, is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar? They meant, according to the law of Moses. So when they ask, is it lawful to put away a wife? They mean, is it lawful according to the law of Moses? Now these questions about healing on the Sabbath and paying tribute to Caesar were touchy questions. But they did not involve an issue that was so highly emotional or dogmatically controversial as they here raise about divorce. They wish to involve Jesus in the controversy, and they feel that whichever route he goes, he will be the loser. These two great rabbis who lived about a generation before Christ, Hillel and Shammai, You can't read any of the books or commentaries without coming to them very shortly. Shammai's school was very strict, saying that only something that was immoral, maybe would not have to be adultery, but at least some kind of sexual impurity. But the school of Hillel was very and utterly lax and permitted divorce on the broadest spectrum. This was a school that was followed by the Jews. Josephus says, divorce may be had for any cause whatsoever. When the Pharisees asked Jesus, for every cause, is it lawful to get a divorce for every cause? They are laying the teaching of Hillel before Jesus. Now then, at this point, I think it would certainly be appropriate to ask, what does the law of Moses teach about divorce and remarriage? The Mosaic law regarding divorce. Let's talk about that for a moment. According to the 21st chapter of Leviticus, the high priest could not marry a divorced woman. As a matter of fact, he could not marry a widow, one whose husband was dead. He had to marry a virgin. The priest could not marry a divorcee. According to the 21st chapter of Deuteronomy, there are some instructions about a woman that's taken in war as a captive. When you're in a battle and see a woman and desire her for your wife, bring her home to your house. She is to shave her head and pare her nails and put the raiment of captivity from her, remain in your house and stay a month. Then you may take her for your wife. If you find no delight in her, let her go where she will, but you must not sell her for money nor deal with her as a slave. 22nd chapter of Deuteronomy. Regarding a husband who falsely accuses his wife of prenuptial unchastity. If you take a wife and go into her and hate her and accuse her of not being a virgin, if parents bring proof that the man is wrong, the elders shall fine the man 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the bride. And she shall be the man's wife, and he may not put her away all of her days. No divorce ever in this case. But if the charge be true, then the damsel shall be stoned to death. Deuteronomy 22, 28 and 29. If a man lay hold of a virgin, one who is not betrothed, and they be taken, he shall give to the father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, and he may not put her away all his days. You know, I've thought just a little bit's crossed my mind on that one. If that might be a case where somebody could profit by sin. Like, here's a fella that wants her for his wife and she doesn't want him. So forcibly he attacks her. Then he has to marry her. So if they are caught, that's someone he wanted. She didn't want him. So, hey, that's profiting from sin. I don't know. One of the pivotal passages, however, would be Deuteronomy 24. This is the one, of course, that Hillel and Shammai went to. If she find no favor in his eyes because he has found some unseemly thing in her, then he shall write her a bill of divorcement, give it in her hand, send her out of his house. She may become another man's wife. But the first husband may not take her again to be his wife, even if the second husband dies. Of course, really, this passage did not intend to state any cause for divorce. The thrust of the passage is, he must give her a bill of divorcement and may not take her back. That's the thrust of it. However, this, if she find no favor in his eyes because he found some unseemly thing. King James Version says, some uncleanness. New American Standard says some indecency. The Jerusalem Bible says some impropriety. The Hebrew says the nakedness of the matter. What does this mean? Deuteronomy 24. If he finds some unseemly thing in her. Well, it doesn't refer to adultery because the law prescribes death for adultery. I have not been able to find at what point the Jews stopped putting people to death for adultery. It may be that somebody can help me on this. But somewhere along the line, they stopped it. I raise some questions that bother me. I wonder why they stopped it. Would we want to say they stopped it because some civil government told them to? Because they were under the heel of foreign power? Would anybody be justified in leaving off what God said to do because the government told them not to? Why didn't they keep up the death penalty? I don't know. Why didn't Jesus rebuke them for having left it off? I don't know. Do you? I wondered about that. It didn't seem to go on too long. Another thing that I wonder is this. If you and I had been living back there, how would we have understood Deuteronomy 24? If you find some unseemly thing, how would you have understood it? Well, Jesus, though, doesn't go back to Mosaic legislation. Look at 4, verse 4. Verse 4 through 6, he answered and said, have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife and the two shall become one flesh. So that they are no more two but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. Now Jesus is asking these Pharisees if they had never read Genesis 1:27 and 2:24. They were wrangling about Deuteronomy 24 and disregarding the Genesis passage. Jesus, in answering them, passes over Mosaic legislation, points to God's act of creation. He made one man, one woman, put them together for life. Anyone who divides what God has by his own creation united flies in the face of the will of God, a serious opposition indeed. But Jesus acknowledges the right of divorce and remarriage under the Mosaic law, but points beyond that law to the order of creation in Genesis. The Mosaic legislation did not abrogate the Genesis law, which was God's ideal. The original purpose of God was that the marriage union should be indissoluble, and this original purpose has never been abrogated. The ideal has not changed. Divorce and remarriage do not correspond to the pure intention of God, and they cannot. Now, not having been given an answer to their question, the Pharisees propound another. We move to verse 7. They say unto him, why then did Moses command to give a bill of divorcement and to put her away? He said to them, verse 8 now, Moses, for your hardness of heart suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it has not been so. You'll notice they asked, why did Moses command to give a bill of divorcement? Jesus replied that Moses allowed that, not commanded. Under the Mosaic law, divorce was permitted. It was permitted as a concession to human failure. Moses' law regarding divorce did not change the original law of marriage of Genesis 1 and 2. It released from the application of that law in recognition of weakness and inability. Moses made concession to the evil condition. His was permission, nothing more. Moses made concession to the evil conditions. And he gives in Deuteronomy 24 the legal way to dissolve a marriage. McGarvey says what Moses does is to take a choice between two evils and take the lesser of the two evils. McGarvey, page 539. Commentary. This did not mean, Mosaic legislation of Deuteronomy 24 does not mean that God had altered his original intention. His law in Genesis 1 and 2 still stands. Jesus proceeds in verse 9. And I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife except for fornication shall marry another, committeth adultery. And he that marrieth her when she is put away committeth adultery. This statement in Matthew 19 and 9 contains both the acceptive clause and the remarriage clause. Each of these clauses appears elsewhere, but only here together. For instance, in Matthew 5:32, I say unto you that everyone that putteth away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, maketh her an adulteress, and whosoever shall marry her when she is put away committeth adultery. In the Matthew 5 passage, there is the teaching against a man divorcing his wife, teaching against remarriage on the wife's part, and nothing said about the status of the husband who divorces her. In the 10th chapter of Mark, whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery against her, and if she herself put away her husband and marry another, she committeth adultery. In the passage in Mark, attention is equally divided between the husband and wife. If either divorces and remarries, adultery is committed. No mention is made of the new partners of each. In Luke 16 and 18, everyone that putteth away his wife and marrieth another commits adultery, and he that marries one that is put away from a husband commits adultery. In this passage, he who divorces and remarries commits adultery, and the second husband of the divorced wife commits adultery. But Matthew 19 contains all of it. That is, it contains the acceptive clause and the remarriage clause. Jesus places an acceptive clause. He says it was in the beginning a certain way. He does not say, as it was in the beginning, so shall it be thenceforth. He also makes a concession. But the law of Genesis 1 and 2 still remains the ideal. Jesus did not take sides with either Hillel or Shammai, as many of the commentators try to suggest. We might bring up the question and discuss it quite briefly. Why did Mark and Luke not have the acceptive clause, except for fornication? Of course, form criticism has dealt with this by proposing that the passages in Mark and Luke are an earlier form of the saying which underwent an alteration in the later life of the church. This is untenable. Another approach, equally as untenable, is that the exception does not come from the lips of Jesus, but is an editorial insertion of Matthew's. This would render Matthew unreliable, which any Bible believer would have to reject. The acceptive clause is in both Matthew passages, both 5 and 19. There is no way to argue against it as not being supported by manuscript evidence, because the evidence is decisive. The acceptive clause ought to be there. We may regard Jesus and Mark and Luke as stating the absolute pure intention of God. The absolute pure intention of God is no exceptions. In the Matthew passage, the exception is given. We do not have to choose between Matthew and on one hand and Mark and Luke on the other. We can accept all of them. Nothing is proved by the absence of a doctrine from one passage which is clearly stated in others. Now then, the question, what does Jesus mean by put away, whosoever shall put away? In all Jewish history, divorce was called a cutting off or a putting away. First century person would certainly have understood this to mean divorce. Jesus meant the disruption of the marriage. Now another question is, whether the acceptive clause applies only to the divorce clause or to both the divorce and the remarriage clause. clauses. Roman Catholic and Anglican theologians have argued at length that the passage permits divorce but not remarriage. I was reading from a book which I think was written by an Anglican. A man by the name of Duty, Guy Duty. He says he's writing his whole book to establish what we practically always have agreed on, that the innocent party, in a case where there's a divorce or fornication, the innocent party can remarry. He is, his whole book is arguing that the innocent can. He says, for more than 20 years, I believe the teaching that forbids remarriage to the proven innocent party in divorce. I was so saturated with this belief that I looked upon those who disagreed with me as being some sort of heretics. In other words, according to the Anglican and Catholic idea, Jesus does permit separation, but he does not permit he permits divorce, but he does not permit remarriage. Incidentally, one of their arguments is that certainly the innocent can't remarry, because everybody agrees the guilty can't. Now, if the guilty remarrying is adultery, this would imply that he's still joined to the innocent. So if he's still joined to the innocent is still joined to the guilty, therefore the innocent cannot remarry. This is one of their arguments. Now, all of this, with many other things, has led to a somewhat tolerant attitude toward divorce when there is no remarriage. And this is filtered down to all levels. A tolerant attitude toward divorce when there is no remarriage. But to put away a companion even when there is no remarriage is to inflict a terrible wrong against him or her. Jesus does not say anything explicitly about the man who puts away his wife and does not marry another. But we can infer, because disrupting the marriage is a grievous sin, remarriage is an aggravating act. Nor does Jesus say anything about a wife putting away her husband, Matthew, but Mark 10:11 places husband and wife on the same level in the matter and gives the wife the same right as the husband. Disrupting a marriage is sinful even when there is no remarriage. Putting asunder what God has joined together is wrong. Jesus does not approve of divorce on any ground except fornication. So we need to stop thinking that one who puts away a companion for some cause other than fornication is blameless, even though remaining unmarried. To disrupt a marriage is wrong. Now what I'm saying here is that there is no such thing in the New Testament as a divorce, where divorce is granted, that doesn't give the right of remarriage. This idea of separation from bed and board is nowhere sanctioned in the New Testament. Jesus does not give the right for separation on any ground. I want us to think on that a moment. Jesus does not, in his law, allow separation on any ground. What about wife beating? Nope. He does not allow separation on the ground of wife beating. Drunkenness? Nope. Non-support? Nope. Jesus does not allow separation in his law on any ground. Seems like we're missing something there, doesn't it? I'd like to appeal to Paul, because Paul is pretty good at dealing with the absolutes of Jesus. So maybe he would help us a little on this idea of separation on beating or something like that. Let me give you a little illustration of how Paul helps us on the absolutes of Jesus. Look at the ethic of Jesus in Matthew 5. Do not resist evil, any evil person. give to anyone that asks you, and anybody that wants a loan, let him have it. Now, that's an absolute, isn't it? Paul, I need you here. I need you on this absolute of Jesus. Could I call a policeman? Now, according to the absolute of Jesus in Matthew 5, no. Paul does call a policeman. How about rebuking an evil teacher? Could I stand up to him? Paul grants us that we can. How about a child? Disciplining a child. How about indigent church members that won't work? Paul says, don't let them eat. Jesus says, give to everybody that asks you. Paul does help a little on that, doesn't he? Dealing with the absolutes, he shows that it is not as absolute as it might have sounded first. So, let's come back to this idea of separation. Paul, will you help me a little? According to the law of Jesus, no separation. But I'm disappointed in Paul because he doesn't help us. For the only separation that Paul allows is one where both parties mutually agree to separate temporarily for prayer and fasting and then bring the separation to a conclusion. Now, that's the only separation Paul allows. Jesus didn't say anything about that. So again, I say that in the law of the New Testament, there is no separation permitted for any cause. Well, let's think now, let's go a little further on this idea of divorce. Fornication. What does fornication mean? Aren't Gingrich say prostitution, unchastity, fornication? They're defining the word porneia, used of every kind of unlawful sexual intercourse. Had a long discussion here, which I'm going to omit, showing that this definition is acceptable. Various types of unlawful sexual intercourse. In other words, porneia, or fornication, is a much broader term than adultery. I accept that definition and found it so used in some of the apocryphal books and also some of the pseudepigraphal books and various other places, although it's not as easy a thing as you'd like for it to be when you start out on it to show that fornication is something other than adultery. But I accept that divorce could be had on homosexuality, for instance, and other things of similar nature. That is fornication. So Jesus sets forth his teaching. Whosoever shall put away his wife except for fornication. And this is far more strict than the law of Moses permitted. Here is a new statement. New law, you might say. Now, a question which raises its head and asks for an answer is this. When does the new law of Jesus become effective? Pentecost. This became effective at Pentecost. Now, when it began to be effective on Pentecost, it would not be retroactive. You know, I'm going to make this little suggestion. Some of the speakers, Brother Woodruff, I don't know about how you take this. Could this be one reason why you don't see anything on Pentecost? You see, everybody out there on Pentecost was scripturally married. Have to be. If the law of Moses permitted divorce and remarriage for various reasons, and it was acceptable to God, then when Peter had those thousands before him on Pentecost, they were all scripturally married. Of course, on the day of Pentecost, you would not have had a lot of breaking up, would you? I just wonder if that might be one reason why you don't see a lot of it there in Acts 2. A lot of breaking ups and confusion and so forth over this problem. I just throw that out as a possibility. Another question that I want to raise. In the event of fornication, is divorce mandatory? I do not believe so. If the wife or the husband has the grace, the ability to forgive, and the other wants forgiveness, it would seem that it could be forgiven and the marriage resumed. Throw out another opinion or two here now. I think, if I were giving some advice on this, that is, if I were a woman married to a man and I found out that he became guilty of fornication, whether or not I divorced him would depend somewhat upon his bent, type fella he is. I would know if that is his tendency. Now, if that is not his tendency, that is not his bent, and I'm sure, feel reasonably sure, that he, being as he is, he was taken in an unguarded moment, and from here on out he has learned his lesson, then I think forgiveness there would be in order. Now, if and she ought to know by now that that is his tendency, she ought to divorce him. I'll tell you one reason why. We had a case like this recently dealing with it over where I preach. And the woman caught the husband red-handed. And with his pleas and begging, she took him back, forgave him. A few months later, he began to mistreat her, stay gone all night, stay away for a week. And she was reasonably sure he was guilty, but she couldn't prove it this time. She paid a dear price for forgiveness, didn't she? It was provable the first time, but not the next. Well, the disciples say unto Jesus, if the case, this is verse 10, if the case of the man is so with his wife, it's not expedient to marry. Well, they're saying if the only charge a man can bring against his wife in order to get rid of her is fornication, it would be better not to marry. In the minds of the disciples, to be tied to a wife so that only fornication on her part would release the husband, so that he would be compelled to put up with her faults for a lifetime, seemed an intolerable yoke to which remaining unmarried would be preferable. My time up?
Yes, sir.
I think I better quit. I got to verse 11 here where it said, not all can receive this saying, and so on, but time is up, so we'll quit.